Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 9th of November. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
46 days to Christmas.
The year's Don't. 46 days till Christmas. Yeah. That means it's, what, 51 days until we're in 2026. Year's, boom, gone.
Year's gone like that. Another year gone. 2025 into 2026. Yeah. Incredible, incredible. I mean, let's have a quick look at some of the news stories that have dominated the headlines this week. The US continues its government shutdown, which has now entered its 37th day since starting on October the 1st. Shutdown is largely due to a funding deadlock over Affordable Care Act subsidies. It's costing the economy roughly $15 billion per week as it continues. Closer to home in the UK, Rachel Reeves is under pressure as she sets out a pre-budget statement. On Tuesday, she made it clear she won't shy away from tough decisions, hinting at potential income tax rises, possibly around 2p, and at the controversial two-child benefit cap. Everyone's waiting to see how the budget will land and what it means for household for finances in the months to come. So I guess, Kev, I mean, I guess the first one is this, the Rachel Reeves, this kind of a statement she made, this pre-budget statement. I don't know if you saw on Tuesday, where she was made it very clear that she's not going to shy away from these tough decisions. Do you think that's affecting the markets around, obviously the UK markets mainly, but do you think that's affecting things in terms of liquidity we've seen this week? In it seems like everyone's kind of like waiting, is cash on the sidelines, do you think?
Yes, I think the last couple of weeks it started to pull out, hasn't it? So it's affected it. I mean, what was that all about? Why you have a pre-budget speech? It's almost like she wants to signal, by the way, it's going to be horrendous. So therefore, I'm going to tell you a bit in advance so that we can all have a bad time, you know, for a bit longer, as opposed to just an initial dip. I mean, it's comical, isn't it? They're letting, you can't blame them specifically, but like this whole, oh, by the way, we've got another rapist out who effectively came from another country that we're paying millions for to house them and to everything else. And this isn't against any asylum seekers as such, but we are like being taken for a ride. It's as simple as that. The whole system has been taken for a ride. If you look at the West and you look at the UK and you look at the US, they're both in a mess. You know, the US is basically saying, we're not going to pay for these things. Okay. And that's why the Republicans and the Democrats can't agree on a budget, because the Republicans are saying, we ain't paying for it. The Democrats are saying, we want to pay for everything. And at the same time, New York City's just voted in in inverted commas, democratic socialist, i.e. communist type individual. You know,
no, we'll get it right. He's been referred to, Mandami has been referred to as a self-professed Jew hater and a communist, as you say. But I mean, I think it's an absolute mess. I mean, Mandani didn't hold back in response to obviously Trump's comments. He told Trump directly, Donald Trump, since I know you're watching, I have four words for you. Turn the volume up. So I think it's going to be an amazing, it's like get the popcorn on that one, because this is going to be an interesting fight, isn't it, as you say?
But to be honest with you, Mandani's going to be fighting with two arms behind his back, whether he likes it or not, right? Because funding and everything else. Did you see the speech that he gave afterwards on the roof, where he was basically saying, it wasn't a speech, it was just like a social media short. He was basically saying, you know, thanks for all the support and da-da-da-da-da. And do you remember a couple of months ago, I told you I didn't need any more cash? So thanks for that. Now I need more cash. So please send in your donations, which is exactly what you'd think wouldn't be asked for once you've already been elected, if you like. I don't know. We'll have to see his politics. I was reading into it and looking at his politics from his family, you know, his mother and father. His mother and father are both Indian. And ultimately, he was born in Uganda. But his middle name is named after the guy who took on the British Empire and made Ghana the republic that it is. So he's a bit of a mixed bag, to be honest. I don't know. And obviously he's Muslim, which I think is very It seems very strange that two Indian parents and Muslim, but maybe that's just
Yeah,
my
exactly. Well,
naivety.
there are a few Indian Muslims, as we know. You know, even when the mad thing is about India, because of its sheer population, the populace, I think, is something like 6% of, or even, but yeah, maybe lower, like 3% of the Indian population are Muslims, and that's higher than the whole of Pakistan's, obviously, predominantly or majority Muslim country. So it's crazy to think that there are more Muslims in India than there are in the whole of Pakistan, just based on the numbers game. But yeah, as you say, it's a historic victory there, becoming the city's first Muslim mayor elect. I mean, is there some similarities? Are they drawing similarities between London with Sadiq Khan and obviously
Well,
Zorawar?
everything on social media is drawing those, isn't it? It's basically
Absolutely.
the American media are basically saying Khan has produced a 10-year knife attack in London,
Yeah,
and
Sharia law and all that sort of thing. And
things have gone down. And there is no doubt that there is partial truths in all of that. There is areas in London now which are dominated by Muslims, and therefore they try and run Sharia law in those places. So yeah, it's what does it tell you? What does it tell you that started probably 20 plus years ago in the West? We see it in France, we see it in Germany, we see it in the UK, we're seeing it in the US. The US seem to be waking up to these things a bit quicker than the rest. And that's why the Republicans are now saying, no more, we're not paying for these things. We're not going to let anybody else in. But I was also looking at one of these Ray Dalio things, and he was talking about, the way that empires rise and fall. And we are right at the end of an empire, like it's in the fourth quarter, if you like. And the empire gets itself in a lot of debt. And then slowly but surely then loses its power. That's what happened in the British Empire after the Second World War. The British Empire was in huge amounts of debt, and then the US dollar came to the rescue. Well, who isn't in a lot of debt? Probably China, India, Russia, the BRICS nations as a whole. I think it's the next empire. Maybe it doesn't happen tomorrow,
No,
but I
this
think
is an
it's
80 to 100 year thing, a generational thing, isn't it? Cyclical, he was saying in the one I heard. So, yeah, interesting. So, who's been summoned to face US Congress? And it's not Prince Andrew because he was stripped of his royal title. It's Andrew, as he's known, the artist formerly known as Prince Andrew, as he used to say. I mean, he's been summoned to face US Congress, obviously, questions on the Epstein links. What do you make of that? Do you think there's more to come out on that?
Yeah, we haven't heard anything yet, have we? I mean, one of the problems with the Republicans and why they've lost a lot of face with quite a few commentators is they basically shut the door on the Epstein files, didn't they? They didn't release them. Everybody then doesn't believe who's in it, who's not in it. If you want to be a conspiracy theory, the whole Epstein thing, a huge Israeli plot to have influence within the government and within people who have a lot of influence in the US, and basically this been happening over 20, 30 years. Is it any different than what the Russians were trying to do? Is it any different than what the Chinese were trying to do? I don't know, but there's an awful lot of connections that go back to Israel, 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 Israel. And yeah, it's all a bit clandestine and a bit scary, really, isn't it?
Well, let's move on to our guest this week. We're delighted to be joined by Colin Bird, Executive Chairman, Martin Churchill's Project Director, and Eugene Nell, Independent Metallurgist at Bezant Resources. So, welcome, gents.
Welcome. Thank you.
So, Colin, do you want to give us an overview of what's happened in the last week? Because it's been pretty monumental in terms of what you've managed to achieve. We have this project called Hope and Gorup in the Namib Desert, and yeah, you tell the story.
Well, we've had many podcasts, and we've had Sunday roasts, and we've had midweek takeaways, and generally we've been discussing, when are we going to get the license, and when are we going to get the environmental license, what shape does the project take, and all the time we've been guarded because of the information we can put out in the public domain when we're trying to second guess something which are totally outside our control. And as you say, you're absolutely right. Over the last few weeks, and we've become more public, more definitive. And I think that probably the main hurdle we jumped was putting the Sound Report, which is our independent engineer and company in South Africa, putting their website, Appraisi, and also the full report, which is over 100 pages, on our website. Now, of course, when you put out that much detail, that obviously our shareholders range from knowing very little about mining, other than it's a nice sort of, if you have a scattergun approach and invest in a portfolio of companies, can be very, very rewarding, all the way through to investors who are quite sophisticated and understand the ins and outs of all of the things we're doing, and they're able to sort of form an opinion based on what they read. And in between those two extremes are many, many interested people who just wonder how we're going to go about this. So I thought it an excellent idea that, and certainly you agreed, fortunately, and so did Charles, that we would in actual fact get together the guys who have done the sweat work, the heavy work and the heavy lifting in putting this together. And I can assure you that there has been a lot of sweat, a lot of heavy lifting, and we're pretty clear on our objectives. And maybe using the report as a basis, Kevin, you and Charles might want to question us, and I guess you've been to your list of readers and members of the who join in Sunday Roast, and a lot of questions have come through to you, and you'll be able to convey to us those questions. So I give it an open forum now to yourself and Charles.
Yep, we've had lots of questions. What's this? What's that? What's them? So, Martin, you're the man on the ground. Give us your overview of what's happening on the project, what's going to be happening next, in terms of physical things to get the copper and gold and silver out the ground.
Thanks, Kevin. Yeah, this week we've sort of reached the point now where we're now sending out letters of intent to all of our key contractors and service providers, doing the drilling and blasting, mining, haulage, and also the two groups, Weir Engineering and Steiner, who are providing us and installing and commissioning the crusher plant and the ore sorter at the mine site, and another company, UMS, that will be overseeing the purchasing and installation and commissioning of all the upgrades at the NLZM plant. So the letters of intent are going out today or tomorrow. So that will then trigger final firm contracts with all of these suppliers and service companies. So that's another significant milestone for us. And we, you know, principally what we wanted to do was make sure we got a little bit of momentum going before the Southern African Christmas break, which sort of starts in the middle of December. So that's all taking place. We're just tidying up the last little bit of geotechnical work. We finished the last sort of optimization work that we were doing on ore sorting. So Steiner now have made a firm decision on the different types of sensors that we'll need in the ore sorter. We are now in the process of talking details with the company that's going to be providing us with renewable power and our solar plant. And we've got a meeting later this week with the group that will be assisting us putting up accommodation and things on the mine. So yeah, and then we've got Unitrans Namibia, who are the company that will be doing, as I said, the drilling, the blasting, and the haulage of the pre-concentrate from the mine site up to the plant. So yeah, lots happening.
So it sounds like you're making a mine.
Indeed, we are. Yes, and I think it'll happen reasonably quickly. The big advantage, of course, is that we took that decision some time ago to purchase the NLZ flotation plant, which is located about 30 kilometers outside of Swakopmund. And we know it's a decent plant. It gets turned over every couple of months, so it's in pretty good condition, and we know what we need to do to just tweak it and in our view improve it. So that's something that we're confident about. And of course, down at the mine site, it's all pretty simple and basic. It's a crusher with some conveyors and connecting up to the ore sorter. And we're fortunate that Weir Engineering and Steiner both have large offices in Swakopmund, so they talk to each other regularly. So we know that both of those key components will fit nicely together. And we've got the utmost confidence in Unitrans to start the mining for us. The first 5 or 6 years of open pit mining, the deepest we'll get is only 150 meters. So, we're not talking mega pits here. So there's, it's all reasonably, hopefully, reasonably straightforward. We're in the middle of the desert, so we're confident that our solar plant will work. We've connected for water up at the NLZM plant into the big regional pipeline that comes out of the Kwesib River and has been providing water to a number of the mines for many, many years.
Yes.
And we're connected to power there as well up at the other side. The roads, we've got a number of options to get pre-concentrate from the mine site up to NLZM. And about the last third of the route is on a nearly new double, you know, tarred highway. So yeah, it's all coming together very nicely, Kevin.
Very good. So from the perspective of actually physically mining, I mean, I've been as green pieces on the ground. You know, the reality is that the weathered copper is from surface. Just explain a little bit, and maybe Eugene can also help. How are we going to mine it? And, you know, from surface, what are we expecting to get as soon as we bring the ore out of the ground?
Yeah, Kevin, if I can jump in here, it's fairly simple mining from surface because the material starts right from surface. And as Martin said, you don't have a pre-strip, so you don't have to remove a lot of material on top of the ore body itself. And so you almost immediately into the mineralized ore body. The material itself at surface, people would have, you often get reported around oxides and sulfides, oxides at surface, sulfides at depth. This ore body is slightly unique in that regard that we get sulfides, which is quite easy to process in a flotation circuit, right from surface down, with and some oxides in between. But very good material to process in the flotation plant that's at NLZM. And we'll access that almost immediately from the first day of mining.
Very good. And from a equipment point of view, what does what do we require and what is already there?
From an equipment point of view at the processing plant, let's take that one first. It's mainly just replacing some of the equipment that has worn over the years from standing. So very limited new equipment that's going to be installed. We are installing a new cone crusher to improve the grinding circuit. And then replacing minor equipment like pumps and tanks. At the mine site itself, it's basically the whole mine fleet. So that would be your drill rigs, excavators, trucks, all its trucks that comes in at the mine site. And then also a two-stage crushing system with a ore sorter. So that's where the main new equipment would be, is at the mine site.
Butting in there, of course, that the mining equipment is part of the contract which we have with the mining contractor. So that will not be purchased by Mizan. We will be basically commissioning the contractor who has the fleet of this sort of equipment, and he will utilize some of his equipment to carry out his task requirement, i.e. dig, remove overburden, dig and send ore to the plant. So you should let's differentiate between what we've got to find, Eugene, and what the contractors provide.
100% correct, Colin.
Okay, so Eugene, in terms of the way that the metallurgical situation is in this open pit, are you expecting that, you know, because obviously you can drill something, but until you actually get in and understand exactly what's there, are you expecting to be surprised on the upside based on what is available, or are you pretty confident it's what it is?
Kevin, the one thing is copper flotation is well known. It's been around for many years, so the process is very well understood. There's been a lot of new developments to improve the efficiency of it. So by employing some of the newer technologies, we expect an upside of it. And then also, we've done quite extensive test work, flotation test work on this material. And the characteristics corresponds very well with other operations, not only in the area, but in the region as well. So we do not expect any nasty surprises. We rather expect better surprises to the upside on that side of things, especially employing some of the newer technologies available.
Yeah. Well, Charlie here, just joining in. The thing is, if you look at the report that we had out recently, looking at the ore sorter pre-concentration percentages, they all seem very conservative, as does the commodity pricing. You know, in that report, gold at $2,800, copper at $9,300, silver at $31, all way below where we are now. So, I mean, potentially, obviously, the metal pricing is elevated, but hopefully you're looking at a much better yield and much better recovery as you get to know the deposit better. Would that be fair to say?
I think it's fair to say that if you do the evaluation of a project, one would always be a little bit more conservative and realistic, with there always being some room for upside going forward. You know, it's no use going to the market or going to shareholders with something that's over-optimistic and then you shoot yourself in the foot. So in these type of studies, one is always a little bit more conservative in nature. So there's always upside potential.
And then in terms of, obviously, I won't ask you to talk about, you know, EBITDA or profit margins. I think that's something we can work out for ourselves. But there's a huge amount of exploration to be done at the site as well once we're up and running and generating revenue, with significant tax advantages as well, because I understand it, costs that go into exploration can be written off against profits. So, you know, let's say we're 2 or 3 years down the line and we're generating revenue. What would you like to be doing with that free cash flow?
We'd certainly be spending some of it on exploration. I mean, I've said this to a number of people, and just taking a step back here, when we reached a point when we decided to apply for the mining license, we'd sort of reached a point where, you know, we recognized that small exploration companies and mine development companies get to a point where, you know, shareholders sort of get exploration fatigue, and you start generating more resources and putting out announcements to say you've added another 1 million tons. And it gets to the point where people are going, well, so what? When are you going to build a mine? So that decision was taken on the basis we said, okay, we've got, you know, we're certain we've now got a 15-year minimum life mine based on what we've drilled out so far. We know that we can achieve payback within, you know, within 48 months, and that we've got a viable project. So let's crack on with that and let's build the mine. But of course, there's huge upside here. If you look within the mining license itself, there's about another 17 kilometers of strike, where we've got drill data, grab samples at surface, dredging, geophysics, you know, a wealth of information, and we can clearly see where the prospective rocks are. So we're confident that we will be adding, you know, easily be replacing depleted resources on an ongoing basis and adding significantly to the resource. And then over and beyond that, we've got another 150 to 180 kilometers of strike, again, where we've got geophysics, some geochem, and some quite sort of, you know, sparse drilling, but nevertheless, we've got some drill intercepts. Again, which is highly prospective. So, you know, there's huge potential there. I mean, we're targeting, you know, 500,000 tons of contained copper as a sort of a start point, and then let's see where we can go from there. I think we could, you know, potentially we could double that with that kind of strike length to deal with. And of course, you know, we've got 69,000 meters of drilling that's been completed by various people over the years. We've done a huge amount of work ourselves. We've got a very, very strong geological team that have been working on this. We now know with our geophysics where effectively the footwall and the hanging wall of the mineralization are. So we know between, you know, the two specifically easily identifiable rock types using geophysics, we know that's where we're going to find mineralization. So, you know, we're not fumbling around looking for targets. We put our, you know, do some further geophysics, and we know exactly where we have to drill. And then, of course, the other thing is, and I think we've spoken to you about this before, is that historically, when a significant amount of work was being done here by JCI and Goldfields, this was in the days when everybody assumed that, you know, you had oxide mineralization in the top 100 meters. And nobody wanted oxides because they didn't really know how to process them. So all the exploration started looking at mineralization from 150 meters and lower. So a lot of these new targets that we have and we know exist, nobody's looked in the top 150 meters. And, you know, we're pretty confident that we will find mineralization again at surface on a number of these other targets. Just a couple of other points, you know, going back and looking at the original mineral resource estimate that was done back in 23, the consultant, you know, they are by nature conservative, and quite rightly so, and they stick to the JORC code, but they were happy to say that they thought extensions to the existing mineral resource, in their words, were extremely likely. So, you know, and they don't say that lightly. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, 500,000 tons to start with is, you know, the key thing, I forgot, and then, you know, potentially doubling that's quite a statement. But I guess, I mean, the thing that you have a significant amount of potentially at surface copper ore that, you know, people that the previous operators, you know, weren't even looking for, and you've got the money to drill for it. I guess the question is too, I mean, what kind of system is it that 180 kilometers covers? And then in addition, are there other licenses nearby that could become satellite pits potentially, where, you know, operators don't have the money to explore, but you like the look of them at the moment? Or is that too far in the future?
It's, well, it's a volcanic massive sulfide type deposit. Yeah. So essentially, you know, if you look at it in sort of layman terms, it's essentially volcanism under the ocean, on the ocean floor. And the mineralization is sort of being formed in that sort of environment. So there's a number of answers to your question. On the northern limb of this sort of boat keel type shape that we've got, this sort of big U, on the northern limb where we've got Hope and all the extensions to Hope, the mineralization there has been sort of overfolded and folded again. So you've got duplication of the mineralization, and you've got a little bit of sort of very localized sort of shearing. So you've actually got remobilization. So the grades can be significant. As we move further along from the initial open pit, you know, it's not uncommon to get intercepts where we're looking at sort of 2 to 3, even higher percent copper with decent gold grades and silver over widths, in some cases, north of 10 meters. And I'm not saying that that is sort of universally what we expect all the way through, but certainly on the northern limb we anticipate that we'll continue to find overfolding and sort of structural contortions and things there in the rock, which means that we'll have bigger package widths and probably better grades. As you go on to the southern limb, you don't have the same amount of disruption, which makes, in some respects, it makes mining easier because it's just a straight line and you just follow it. But what's interesting on that southern limb is there are some intercepts at depth. We didn't drill these are drilled historically. Mineralized widths are narrow, they're only about a meter, but we're talking grades. Peak grades we had were 20% copper and 20 grams per ton gold, and I think there was another hole which was about 2 or 3 meters beneath that, which had, again, I think it was about 3.5% copper, and I think it was still close to 20 grams per ton gold. So there are other things going on in this deposit that we've not even had time to look at yet. So yeah, there's a lot of upside here.
Well, this is the thing, right? Because obviously you have that kind of geology that, you know, mostly you're looking for copper and gold, but, you know, Namibia, lead, cobalt, uranium, lithium, tin, tantalum. If you're exploring such a massive strike with future cash revenues, it feels almost like a surprise box, right? You're never quite sure what you might uncover.
Yeah, although we don't expect to find any other sort of base metal deposits or anything else. We're sitting in this matchless member, and that extends all the way through past Windhoek and then carries on all the way out towards the Botswanan border, and it's basically amphibolite type rocks which then sort of wedge a whole load of quartzites and schists in between them. So it's pretty much the same geology all the way through for 300 odd kilometers all the way through to Windhoek and beyond. So I don't think we'll find other deposit types, but conversely, what it means is that we know exactly what we're going to find in terms of mineralization. So we've essentially got our vectors for exploration. We know what we're looking for. We know what we want to find. And if we find those various sort of characteristics there, then we know that's the place we should drill.
In terms of getting this thing up and running, my suspicion is it'll take less than a year, and I don't want to ask you for a forward-looking statement, but for deposits like this, and based on, you know, operations that have gone online in the past, do you reckon less than 12 months it can be up and running from now?
Well, what I would say is most of the projects, your longest lead item is normally to construct your plant and tailings dam. And then also to get your pit established, so if there's a pre-strip. The fact that we don't have a pre-strip and we've already got a plant in place that we just need to do a sort of minor modifications and fix up to, we'll probably be able to halve the time to get into production from a normal greenfields type operation. So I think the listeners can figure out, but you'll probably halve your time.
Mm. Excellent. And then with the plant, once it's gone through the beneficiation upgrade, are you going to have spare capacity in it? Because obviously you're going to, when you start out with this, with production, generally you start out with a little bit and then you optimize and then you go bigger and bigger. But are you going to have spare capacity as well for more ore from other sources? Or do you think it's going to be maxed out?
If you look at the results we've been seeing at the moment, we're probably going to be filling up that plant to the brim. So at the moment, the plant is the bottleneck. The mine has got a lot more that it can give, and the plant is the limit. We'll be running that at full blast.
Good.
But you should remember, Charles, that this is, Martin referred to the ingestion and expiration. The government wanted it to see an operation. So we're very much approaching this as phase one and phase two. This is phase one, and if Martin's target, and you know, we're all a bit reluctant to say 500 is our minimum, because we know damn well just by simple math that we're going to get a lot more copper than that, because we're relating it to the 69,000. So the second phase, of this operation, we'll be aiming for a new plant and 20 to 25,000 tons per annum. And maybe it's not that futuristic. It's obviously dependent on finding a minimum of 500,000 tons. But maybe, Martin, if you tell the podcast a wee bit about that, it would be useful, I think, because we don't want people, Charles, to think that this is the start and end of Open Gorup.
It's
certainly the start, but it's phase one. And if Martin could articulate how we would approach phase two, I think listeners might be intrigued.
So as Colin said, you've got phase one where we're basically, we will fill the nameplate capacity for the float plant, even after we've tweaked it and made some improvements. I think one point to make, which goes back to what Charles is saying, is that we've worked out that because of the efficiency of the ore sorter and the mass pull that we will be achieving, every 2 years we will have stockpiled at the mine site another year's worth of pre-concentrate feed to go into the plant. So from day one, we're already, you know, sort of we've got surplus. The plan thereafter is, and of course the reason we're using your sorter at the mine site is because we didn't want to have to try and negotiate for a water pipeline, you know, all the way through the desert for I'm not sure how many kilometers. However, if you go about 50 kilometers, maybe 55 kilometers to the sort of the north-northwest of our mine site, you get to a point where there is a pipeline and a big pumping system which pulls water from the from an aquifer in the Kwisab River, and that water then flows up past Walvis Bay, the big deep water terminal on the coast, and then goes inland and feeds all of the mines. And that's been feeding some mines for over 30, 35 years now. Yeah. So it's been there a long time. So phase two, you know, once we've got more resource under our belt, is to build a new, much larger plant that will produce, as Colin says, we'd be aiming for 20, 25,000 tons of copper per annum. And that will be based there, because we would be right next to the source of the water. We could actually have a float plant there as opposed to another, you know, bunch of ore sources. So we could have a completely separate flotation plant, which would then be about 40 kilometers away from the Walvis Bay and the deep water terminal.
Remember, Charles, we're producing all the time we're building that plant, aren't we, Martin? It's not as though there's a production interruption. It's basically nothing stops until the other plant is ready to bring into commercial production.
Exactly. Yeah, we just keep going when we're feeling that we've got enough additional resource under our, you know, in the inventory, then we can start looking at that second plant.
And I mean, potentially you have that second plant maybe in mind. There's a few around that you might be thinking about purchasing, or you've not got that far ahead yet.
No. We'd be building
from scratch.
Yeah, we'd be building one from scratch. Yeah.
Well, that'd be very exciting. And then in terms of you know, say you've dug out the copper, you've blasted it, you've done the ore sorting, is there a potential to further optimize it before it gets sent to the plant? You know, recrushing, regrinding, gravity concentration, scrubbing, and any additional steps, or do you want to keep the flow sheet as simple as possible?
There are a couple of upsizing benefits and other products and things that we can get out of it, and I'll let Eugene talk you through those.
Yeah, Charles. The thing is, there is some of the ore, the low grade and medium grade ores. While you're upgrading the ore sorter, you do reject some of the material, and some of that reject material would be very amenable to a leach to produce cathode copper instead of concentrates. So that is sort of one of the type of things that one would incorporate into this new bespoke plant, or the new from scratch built bespoke plant. You would incorporate some of those processes to treat some of the old waste from the existing circuit.
Yeah.
And then also the ore body itself contains quite a lot of magnetite. And preliminary work has shown that, you know, that can also be recovered as a byproduct during the process, which we haven't even, we know about it, but we haven't actually fully developed that side of things. And there's upside potential to take that magnetite out either as a feed source to the coal operations or as a feed source to some of the steel smelters.
This is the thing, right? I mean, you're if you're building it from scratch, you can do a lot more. But I'm guessing what I'm getting at is that if you spend, you know, a significant amount of time on phase one, you're going to have huge tailings piles filled with copper, filled with magnetite, potentially a little bit of gold and silver in that, you know, is not going to make it through ore sorting. But you'll then be able to, once you've got, you know, the second plant up and running, you'll then have a massive amount of material just to sift through that's already pre-mined, just sitting in a dump, right?
But I think the holders haven't got to wait. Correct me if I'm wrong, Eugene. They haven't got to wait till the second plant is there, because we could do small vat leaching during the course of the next few years once we get ourselves settled down on this flow sheet and start producing. And the opportunity for the magnetite and the opportunity for small vat leach is not 6 or 7 years away. It's somewhat immediate. Just to, you know, explain how we might take short-term advantage to get the last squeal out of the pig, so to speak.
Yeah, and not only that, is this early sort of early startup plant will give you a lot of valuable information on the material itself. So it totally de-risks the bigger plant that you construct. Because you're gonna get so much more information than you would have gotten out of lab scale test work anyway. So when you do build the big plant, you already know exactly what you need and what you need to do.
Yeah. I mean, when you say build, where would you ideally build the big plant? Would it be adjacent, or would you want to have it right next door so you wouldn't have to do the trucking?
No, that is what Martin spoke about earlier, is that it would be a lot closer to the mining site. And it would ideally be as close as possible where there is both a water and electrical supply as well. So that would be the driving factors, that you don't have to bring a big water pipeline in. So it would be a significantly closer. That's the 50, 60 kilometers away that Martin spoke about earlier.
So kind of stepping back a bit, it's kind of big picture. Let's say it's 5 years from now, say, which feels like a long time, but as we all know, really isn't. What does the operation look like? How much copper are we producing? How much are we processing? Or do we have that second plant potentially online? And, you know, how big could this thing get, especially if you're doing the exploration as well?
It's almost like asking how long is a piece of string.
It is. I know. I realized as I asked it, but, you know, I had to ask anyway.
I think, Charles, we can lay out that obviously we're going to climb into it as soon as this free cash flow, which is not unencumbered, isn't needed for the plant. We're going to be drilling, and we're not going to chuggle away with one machine. Martin is determined to make it a three machine exercise. So really, that's in the, let's say it takes you 18 months to settle down. You're not going to wait for the outcome of that before you start doing all your planning permissions, environmental, mining, you know, sort of mineral processing plant permissions, and all the things that you have to do, and all the negotiations which are outside your control and take time. And then there's the financing aspects of it as well. So look at the plant, which is being commissioned in the not too distant future. Look at the cash flow going into an intense drilling program. Then looking at say year two and a half, you're into mine planning for the new mine. You're into designing the ultimate flow sheet and the shape and the size of the mine. cost in the mine, deciding which way you, the process plant, which way you're going to go with your process plant, what does the flow sheet look like. So you chug it along years one, you're up to full capacity at year two and a quarter, generating probably maximum cash flow. At year four, you probably start building your new plant. So at year six, because these things, you know, it'll be a big plant, Charles. It'll be a big plant. A couple of years to build. So year six, you should be kicking that in. So you'll have steady state of around about 7,000 ton a year from year one to year five. And then that plant gradually comes in. And I guess you might run the two in tandem. Who knows? You might run the two in tandem. And so by year eight, you're doing 25,000-30,000 tons of copper.
Compared to at the moment, we're looking at significantly less, right?
Of course. But, you know, you could always regard that as our starter for 10. That's our starter for 10. And, of course, you should never forget, Charles, that there's a million tons of zinc, lead and zinc. So when, in actual fact, we phase in the big mine, we've got the NLZM plant available for a deposit, which has got at least a million tons of zinc and lead and zinc ore, and we believe is extendable. But the plan looks something like that. Get the operation going, excess cash flow when it's readily available, do a real exploration, exercise three machines, take the planning phase whilst you're working, start building your new plant at year four, year five, and by year seven, six, seven, you should be phasing out of plant one into plant two, that order. And you might run both plants, because I don't think there's going to be much constraint on how much ore you can produce. It's how much you can process. That's the constraint.
And then you have the, Colin, this conditional prepayment facility of up to $7 million. And then the concentrate offtake agreement. In the RNS with a globally recognized commodities trading company, I mean, people are guessing, and I won't ask you because you won't answer who that is, but surely that provides some additional commercial validation, right? Because they're not going to hand over that money unless they're pretty confident they're going to see it back.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, the scenario that I'm painting, if you step off that, then look at what we all expect on this call and what the market now expects and the analysts are all predicting. That second phase, we're not even anxious about it being financed, because it's what we do in phase one will in actual fact set the stage for everything else we do over the next few years. And if you're referring to the immediate, then of course our provider, our offtaker, is doing some standard due diligence, and we're fairly confident of, you know, that I think the words are, we've done this project to death, Charles. We really have. And I tell you what, my experience, as most people in this business, the more you look into a mining project, the more it goes a wee bit south. Not fatal flaws, but something what eats away at the cash here, eats away at the margins there. But we're not seeing that, Charles. And I think a best way of saying it, I mean, let's face it, what was the variable? And the variable was the pre-concentration or sort of. And maybe Eugene would like to talk about, you know, he took it from the lab, he took it to full scale. Martin was insistent that he couldn't put his name to this unless there was pilot scale testing. We managed to get the benefit of a big, you know, of a unit similar to our unit, and did the test. But I'd like, probably, if Eugene, you can take us through what you did from lab to full scale and how it actually panned out, and there's some shocks and surprises, I think even more surprises than there weren't many shocks, but just for the listeners, I think it'd be interesting to know how that process worked.
Yeah, Colin and Charles and you guys, the thing is, it's an iterative process. So the test work ran over three or four stages. And every time you put it through the ore sorter, you learn something about how it works. And we sequentially put more and more material through and taught the ore sorter what the ideal material would look like. So the last run that we had was as close as possible to an optimal setup. And we could achieve well in excess of 85-90% recovery of copper into a final product. So the test work wasn't just a single pass, a single shot in the dark. We ran about four different iterations, and each time we'd go back teach the ore sorter and tell it, okay, where did it go wrong and what should it do better? And slowly progressed and got the efficiency quite high that, you know, the ore sorter rejects is sitting at 0.1% copper, which is actually quite low.
I mean, it's all looking very, very positive. And, you know, the thing is, it's two investment cases, right? And it's the phase one, which is what's going to happen potentially over the next 6 to 12 months, getting into production, generating revenue. And then there's a second investment case, which is, you know, longer term, 5 years down the line, where you've potentially got a second plant online, which is much larger. You've got massive exploration done. You've got 1 million tons, you know, explored and ready to go. And yet we sit under this market cap down here of, you know, you're basically nothing. The potential, you know, from a geological point of view seems extraordinary. That's what it sounds like to me anyway.
It is. And it's not, you know, and it's easy to claim credit after the event, but it's been Martin and my style to go out. And when we looking at new ventures, we always like the situation where majors have been. Often in the 70s, the mistakes were made. But where majors have been as recent as a few years ago, the small mining capability, because we regard that as important, because, you know, cash has been very, very difficult to access since July 21. It's been extremely difficult to access cash. So we've looked for positions where you can bring small mines into being, and you'll see that in the group. You see those situations. But most importantly, they're attached to huge mine potential. And if there ever was one what fitted the bill, it's Hope and Gorup and the Matchless Copper Belt. Maybe you'd like to add to that, Martin.
No, definitely. You know, when it was first looked at back in the 80s, yeah, Goldfields were looking for the next Copper Belt, literally. And, you know, copper price tanked and they essentially pulled out and moved on. But we're very fortunate. I mean, if the Matchless Belt was not in the middle of the Namib Desert, then, you know, if it was in somewhere like Canada or Australia or wherever and closer to civilization, then I don't think what we're looking at now would be there. I think it would have been mine 40, 50 years ago, to be frank. So the fact that we've got access to this existing resource, and then we've got, you know, 180 odd kilometers of very prospective strike length in addition is pretty unique in today's setting. You know, it's getting harder and harder to find quality resources, and you know, we're convinced that this is one. We know, looking at mines that sit in the Matchless Belt that have operated in the past, that they produce nice clean concentrates and that they respond well to flotation. As I mentioned earlier, we're in a situation where we understand the geology sufficiently well now that we can look at geophysical signatures and say, right, drill here. This is where we need to be. So we're not sort of hunting for targets. We know exactly where they are. And it's just a case now of you know, sequencing that exploration and making sure that we sort of get into the habit and the routine of adding resources on a regular basis.
Yeah, good.
Very good.
Yeah. Anything else to add?
I mean, just the only thing I've got to add is a personal thing. When we were there, you know, watching, you know, the process of going through the VMSs, if you understand what volcanic mass sulfide looks like on the surface, it's just like a black sea hole, if you like, where a lot of the gas and the heat had escaped. So they're not exactly difficult to identify in the desert. We saw a minimum of three of them. And I mean, I presume you've driven this 180 kilometers, Martin. How many of them are there potentially?
Well, look, if you go across to, if you start on the northern limb, you know, you've got Hope, and then you've got Anomaly, Dupree, and a couple of others, and then we're not sure how many more after that. These are prospects. If you go onto the southern limb, you've got Gorup and Vendome, Luigi, and a number of other targets. And then when you get onto the other two contiguous licenses, there are two or three quite substantial targets there that have been looked at by some of the majors back in the 80s. So yeah, there's a huge amount for us to look at. And probably the biggest challenge is, you know, there was I've seen it many times before where you've got a mining operation and the exploration team thinks that if they're not at least a day's drive away from the mine, then they're not doing exploration. The reality is we've got extensions to the existing mineralization. So, you know, we only have to move the rig a very short distance and we're just sort of, you know, drilling down, you know, down the sort of the strike. But at the same time, I do think it's important for us to get out onto the other licenses, partly because we need to demonstrate to the government, obviously, that we're busy on those licenses. Otherwise, you know, we would struggle with renewals. But we want to get out there because there may be something substantial that we don't know about at this stage. So it is important to crack on and look at that other 180 Ks of strike. But, you know, as I said previously, we know what we're looking for. We know the signs and we've refined the techniques that we use to identify the sort of the priority targets. And we've got the team who are fine-tuned and well-versed in what they need to do. And we just let them loose.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Namibia is a great country in which to work, gentlemen. And that matchless copper belt, I more or less, Martin made a statement, you know, the surprise to us that the opportunity is still there, isn't it, Martin? Because quite frankly, there was somebody tumbled over a few years ago, and that I suppose that managed to write off the matchless copper belt. But the matchless copper belt is one of the best huge extents of copper in really consistent occurrence on this planet. And yet it stands there underexplored, more or less. The real exploration has been at both ends, i.e. close to Windhoek, 25 kilometres, and the southern end near Walvis Bay. And the bit in between being about 300 kilometres, 350 kilometres, is continuous and has got showings all the way along. I think I'm correct there, aren't I?
Certainly. I think part of the reason that not a great deal has been done is because, you know, water is the principal thing. You're looking at a sulfide ore body that responds well to the flotation, and you're in the middle of nowhere and you've got water. So, you know, access now to ore sorting technology. Yeah, we're very fortunate that we happen to have access to these licenses at a time when ore sorting technology is sort of advancing almost on a monthly basis. And we now know that we're not afraid of finding a deposit like this anywhere in this desert, because we know we can almost certainly produce a high grade pre-concentrate that we can then make a plan with and get to get to a plant or find somewhere with water where we can build a plant. And I think that was the key to this, is being able to combine this type of deposit with ore sorting technology. It's made all the difference.
That's unlocked it, doesn't it, Martin? And when you think a modest grade of 1.2 can be multiplied by 4 to 4.8, but let's call it 4.5, that can stand a lot of trucking, and that compresses compresses the matchless copper belt, doesn't it? Compresses it so you don't have to build a plant every 5 minutes. You don't want dedicated plants within a couple of kilometres of the mine site. There's a lot you can do even though you're in the desert. And of course, Kevin, it's dry. That's the big issue. It's dry, isn't it, Martin?
Yeah, very much so. So, you know, we're not expecting, we're not going to be doing huge amounts of pumping and things out of our... out of the bottom of our open pit, for example. You know, there's hardly any water, which again is reflected in the fact that we've got sulfide mineralization right from surface.
Very good, gentlemen. Well, listen, we look forward to speaking to you in the not too distant future as all these things progress. It's exciting stuff. You know, the whole development of this first phase, and then subsequently, I'm sure there's going to be lots of news over the next period of time as you start to drill some of these other VMSs. And I suppose that the reality is that those VMSs, the ones close to Hope and Gorup, have been drilled already anyway. So you will just be filling in the gaps in terms of the drilling with the 69,000 meters that's already been drilled. But yeah, we look forward to seeing how everything moves forward and how quickly you can get into production.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Kevin. It you know, you've sensed the enthusiasm of Martin and Eugene, and I can assure you that if the guys who were reporting to them were to come onto this podcast, you'd have got the same enthusiasm. You might have not got the same control, but you've certainly got the same enthusiasm and excitement. And that's what gets me out of bed in the morning. Great team. They've done work very, very diligently, very, very professionally in what is a challenging environment. And we've had a few things work for us in the last few months, but the underlying work has been over the last 3 years. It took 3 years to happen overnight, sort of thing. So thank you very much for giving us the time. Thanks, gents, for your contribution. And I hope our listeners will share the enthusiasm that we've got as the Open Garup team.
Indeed. Thanks for your time, guys. And we look forward to having another question and answer thing like this again.
Thank you.
Okay, I mean, let's have a look at the wider markets. So we've seen, obviously, during the week, global stocks experienced another day of turbulence after major technology shares dragged markets lower. We saw the S&P 500 and NASDAQ fall sharply, and Europe's Stock 600 index dropped for a third consecutive session as fears over high valuations in AI-linked companies spooked investors. Analysts noticed that AI-related shares were up dramatically in early 2025, but investors are now nervously eyeing profit margins and lofty valuations. It's starting to feel like the late stages of a bubble, said one strategist, drawing comparisons to the dot-com boom of the late 1990s. On Tuesday, Nvidia shares fell by more than 5%, wiping billions off the market value, with the chief executive Jensen Huang attempting to calm investors by reaffirming the firm's long-term AI growth strategy, but admitted volatility in tech is to be expected. I guess we saw also large cap AI semiconductor stocks, including Microsoft as well, Alphabet and Arm Holdings also suffering losses, while Asian markets mirrored the decline. So not a great week there, Kev, for the AI and
not exactly putting my neck on the line, but it's a bubble. It's absolutely ludicrous. The valuations are absolutely ludicrous. And the interesting thing is, obviously, we've just been speaking with Colin and his team about Bazant. I'm not going to talk too much about Bazant, but at the same time, there's a huge upside in Bazant. Nobody sort of really clicked, I think, how big this project really is. We've seen a net present value of sort of around the $50 million mark, but actually, it's potentially 5, 10, 15 times that size based on the strike length and stuff like that. But here's a question for you. How much are all the AI companies worth if we don't have enough copper, silver, and potentially gold to create these data centers, to create the electricity that needs to be delivered?
Exactly. No, I totally agree. I mean, Nvidia hitting this $5 trillion valuation, and you look at their revenues, etc. And I know that they've announced that they're going to have like a $500 billion contracts in the pipeline for next year. But even still, the valuations are absolutely, they're crazy. And I do feel as if that some of these, you know, analysts have said that the bubble does feel like it's going to burst. But I agree with you completely. Like, without any of these critical minerals, in fact, the US just added, didn't they, copper and silver and even met coal to the critical minerals list. So they're starting to realize that if they want the infrastructure in place, they have to be treated like that.
Yeah, don't start me on met coal. Right, silver for sure. Silver's becoming a big issue as an industrial metal, just as much as the fact that it's massively... I mean, the contracts that are being sold in silver now is just comical, because ultimately there's no silver there. We had a bit of an uptick there because basically they couldn't provide the silver. Things like the Diwali in India, where there was huge, you know, personal demand for the silver at that point, and that coincided with holidays in other places as well, which were celebrating. But I digress. The reality of the situation is that all of these things, or all of the AI tech things, need copper more than they need anything else. It's like, if we don't have copper, then basically you can't transmit the stuff. You can't generate the electricity in the first place to then transport it, which is what the copper is required for, you know, being a great conductor. We were researching there ourselves, weren't we, about the copper-gold ratio.
and it is actually at an all-time high. All-time low, and historic low. And the reality is that because gold is overpriced, or because copper is very, very cheap, or a combination of the both? You know, the reality is copper's got some serious catching up to do in terms of how much it could move. It's talking about copper going up 3-4 times just to go back to its normal copper gold ratio. So that would just be amazing if you saw copper at $20,000-$30,000 a ton. How beneficial is that for Kazan's project Hope and Garb with gold and copper? How beneficial is that for Extract's Bushranger project? What other copper projects are there that are ongoing that could?
I mean, there's a multitude of them out there, isn't there? You know, various different companies. You know, even Aterian in the north of Morocco, in places like, you know, the big projects that they've got up there. There's vast number. But I mean, interestingly, we had a chat this week, didn't we, with a Bitcoin. I'm not going to call him a maxi, but basically a big Bitcoin fan, and it was an interesting comment. Just going back to your copper, the requirement. And it was like AI and Bitcoin are so energy intensive that they're relying. It was almost like this prophecy of where, like, AI is almost built to consume as much energy as possible and just continue and almost like burn out, deplete the world's reserves. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was an interesting, almost a conspiracy theorist, but it is interesting that people don't realize that Bitcoin and AI are so energy intensive as commodities.
Yeah, and that throws you into a conspiracy theory about this this other thing that would basically create the energy of the sun, isn't it? I forget, is it fusion or fission?
Yeah, fusion.
Where you actually use tungsten. So shock horror, you need another metal, and GMET's done that. You know, started coming back this week after a bit of a normal correction, I think, in the market. Up to, I think, 120, I think it was, on a Friday. But if we don't have these metals, AI ain't going anywhere.
No, absolutely, you
know,
not.
And it's the same, you know, whether it be copper, which I think is the main one. I'm starting to see lots of different podcasts, things on YouTube about 2026 is going to be the year of copper. You know, because basically now there's a shortfall. 3 or 4 of these big mines are having problems during 2025. That's going to mean that there's going to be a shortfall of copper. And that's without the extra demand that is required for all of these AI data centers, all these AI, you know, products, if you like, that are required, and the extra electricity that's got to be provided. If you're providing a huge amount of electricity, how thick a copper wire do you think you're going to have to go into these places to produce, you know, the relevant amount of electricity for these places? Is it's going to be huge. So I just don't think that is without, and Colin Bird always says this, there's 1.3 billion people or 1.4 billion people in India who, how many 100 million of those just want a fridge?
Yeah.
Just want a car of any description. And the same in China. And, you know, the same in many African countries as well. So the demand for this metal is off the charts, but yet we haven't actually seen the move in copper as yet.
Yeah. So who's been given a pay rise this week?
Been given a pay rise. It's not me anyway, that's for sure.
Well, I can tell you it was probably the largest pay package ever agreed. Yeah, Tesla shareholders overwhelmingly approved Musk's controversial, valued at around $1 trillion, the largest in corporate history. Originally devised in 2018, the all-stock compensation plan grants Musk no salary or cash bonus, but up to 12 tranches of stock options, each unlocked only if Tesla achieves increasingly ambitious milestones in market cap, revenue, and profitability. The target began at $100 billion, and rose in 50 billion increments to a maximum of $650 billion, all of which Tesla has already surpassed at various points, effectively securing Musk's eligibility for the full award. At the current valuations, the package could net him over $55 billion in stock, depending on Tesla's performance and share price. Supporters argue that it ties Musk's rewards directly to shareholder return and visionary leadership that turned Tesla into the world's dominant EV and clean energy company, while critics call it an example of extreme wealth concentration and the failure of corporate governance, especially amid recent layoffs and declining margins. I mean, get your head around that, Kev. $1 trillion pay package.
Yeah.
Is it right? Is it right that someone, one person, has that wealth?
Can we negotiate that from the roast? Or,
yeah. 0.001% commission.
No, I mean, the interesting thing is, if we go back to what's happening with the US dollar, how much is $1 trillion going to be worth, like 10 years down the line? How much? It could be a mere $150 billion. I mean, it's crazy numbers. Let's put it this way. But without Musk, Tesla is probably dead in the water, right? So they know themselves, if they don't actually keep the mastermind, if you like, then the company is based on Musk, isn't it? So,
yeah.
And there isn't another company out there that is as based on one individual as Tesla. The question is, he believes, and everything I've listened to or read believes, that they're going to become a self-driving company, which is effectively going to be one of the biggest taxi firms in the world. That's how they're going to make their money, on a SaaS platform, basically. So each car will be, many, many times more profitable than it currently is. And secondly, on AI robotics, which is basically to provide the robots that AI will be able to, link into allow it to take over all the different jobs. Now, if he achieves those two objectives in the same way as he's achieved his objective with Tesla, the car, then good luck to him. But I mean, well, I think the company, for him to receive everything, has to be worth $8 trillion.
Yeah.
Which is, twice.
It's not just the market cap, as you say, it's down to the market cap, the revenue and profitability. So there's the three factors that are within that kind of plan that will enable him to get that. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, NVIDIA at 5 trillion, as you say, currently. Who's to say that in another 8 to 10 years, then that Tesla can't be at 8 trillion,
Well, if you quote, good friend Mr. Rick Rule, and the US dollar devaluates by 75% over the next 10 years,
yeah,
then, for something to be worth 10 trillion, it's actually only got to be worth 2.5 trillion in today's money. Okay. Yeah. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility if you have a depreciating dollar, So, and can Tesla be worth $3,000, $4,000 a share? Well, they seem to think so, based on some crackpot calculations that this has done XYZ and this has done XYZ and this has done XYZ. Mm. And these people are very firm that the future is for changing and this is what's going to happen. I'm very firm on the fact that if we don't get the copper out the ground, we don't get the silver out the ground, and we don't get the gold out the ground in terms of being a valuable asset, then all of their plans are pointless.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you hear that in the background? There's a volley of gunfire going off, like rapid gunfire, which is quite worrying. But I've realised that they're actually filming the new Fast and Furious film up at Greenham Common. There's the airbase, and they filmed the previous one about 3 years ago. And there was people posting on social media, helicopters flying around and stuntmen doing all the things. You can actually go and watch it through the sort of wire fence. But yeah, since 7 o'clock this morning, all I've heard is every now and then is cars revving, screeching tires, and then a volley of like rapid, machine gun fire. Yeah, which is,
reminds me of my years in Belfast, that thing.
Yeah.
Only it wasn't the film being shot, unfortunately.
So what have you been up to this week, Kev, anyway?
Feeling pretty sick, to be honest. The weather's still very beautiful, but it's changed a bit. We had a bit of rain at the end of last week, and the kids got the lurgy, and then I got the lurgy, and
isn't there at the moment, this time of year, as the weather changes, we go into seasons. But yeah, I've had an interesting week. Tuesday I went to the premiere of the Luca film, Luca Montezemolo, with Chris Harris and friends down at Bristol Everyman Theatre. Have you ever been to an Everyman cinema? It's an independent chain, mate. Honestly, there's like sofas in there. You get a sofa, you get like a table on there with your drinks, and they can bring food to you at the beginning. You're getting there 10 minutes early, they bring burgers to you. Amazing cinema, Art Deco building, absolutely incredible place. So I'd recommend, if you ever get the chance, you're in London or one of the big cities, find your local Everyman and go and experience that. But what a movie that was. And
I'd be in my burger and lying down on the sofa and I'd be asleep. What's the point of that?
Your shoes kicked off, wouldn't you, and be asleep? Yeah,
it was doing that.
Go on, anything else to sport?
We've got not really. Again, I'm just looking again, just looking forward now. I mean, as we said at the start of this, we are literally only a number of trading days. It'd be interesting how many trading days we are. Probably no more than about 30 trading days away from 2026. So we're going to start looking at what's going to be happening at the end of this year and also then what's happening going into 2026. We've had a great year in terms of the resource sector, if we take a step back and have a look. But I genuinely think this is only the beginning. This is only just the start of what I think is going to be a massive bull run in resource equities. We've been saying it now for 3 years, but now we've had 1 year where it's been good. Now people are starting, hopefully, to wake up to the fact that there's a lot of undervalued stocks on the UK market that are resource-based. These things are a requirement if this tech thing is even going to happen. Never mind, it's going to keep growing, because if they don't have these resources, it can't happen.
Yeah. Agreed. And I think we saw that this week, didn't we? I mean, there are the odd offer coming in for some of the interest. I think Asia Met had an offer, didn't they, agreeing to sell the interest in that project in Hong Kong for £81 million in cash on a debt-free basis. So I think that reacted very well. So it is nice to see these offers coming in for these companies. So yeah, let's watch this space on that. And I don't know how I feel about the remainder of the year. I mean, we saw a lot of liquidity coming back into the market between sort of September and October, but it feels like November has been off to a bit of a damp squib. It feels like the last couple of weeks, as we said at the top of the show, that it's been a bit of a liquidity sucked out. But let's hope you're right and that there is an influx of people. Maybe once the budget's out the way, is it the 26th of the month, and people have got more of a clear idea what's going on, and hopefully it's not as bad as everybody thinks it is. And, you know, we can get back onto seeing some of these companies move and have fair valuation, because, as you say, everything's getting... Still not anywhere near real valuations.
Yeah, I think people are waiting for certainty in terms of the budget. And I also think people have waited for certainty over the US shutdown of the government. I think they're the two big things that are happening that are affecting like equities across the world. Obviously, the budget is only a UK-based thing, but in the small caps, that makes a difference, doesn't it? People are like, if we're going to get hammered again for whatever it happens to be, capital gains tax or, you know, just general taxation increases, which are inevitable, right? We have reached a point where every pound that is added to this tax threshold means they get less tax. Okay, it is bizarre.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I was looking at this, and I think that what Rachel is proposing is to increase the income tax by even a penny. But if you look at, she's actually talking about decreasing NI at the same time. So even though they're going to be getting more into the coffers, it's actually not going to affect those who are on the 25,000, the 50,000 area of, you know, their wages, their income. It's going to be the ones on the 75 and above who are going to see an impact on their actual take-home pay. So actually, she's doing it in a way that kind of takes with one hand but gives back with the other, if that makes sense. And I mean, I don't know. That's my understanding of the income tax movement, but also a reduction in the NI, the employee NI. That's my understanding of it.
Yeah, well, we'll just have to wait and see, won't we? But I mean, regardless of you know, taking with one hand and giving with the other, I think it's called the Laffer curve, isn't it? And that was the guy that was involved with Hammack Gold. You know, there comes a point where you get diminishing returns on how high the tax is. Yeah. And the UK, I mean, Charles will give you a lot of stuff on this, but the UK has crazy situations around £100,000 income where you can effectively, if you've got, you know, student loans and other things, you can be paying 81% tax,
yeah,
which is going back to the Labour's, you know, the Labour governments of the 70s in terms of, you know, basically it was just absolutely pointless doing any work. The problem that they've got now is that the freedom to go somewhere else, whether that be Cyprus, Dubai, you know, the Cayman Islands, etc., for the super wealthy, it's there. People are going to start taking that opportunity, I think, because it's like, why would I do that? If you were setting up a brand new business now and you had the opportunity to set it up in Dubai or set it up in the UK, where would you set it up?
Yeah, I mean, if you're doing most of your business out in Dubai there or not in the UK, then obviously, you know, you'd go for that, wouldn't you, as an option? But the interesting thing is, since they've touted about potentially introducing this mansion tax on properties over sort of, you know, 1 million or 1.5 million, house prices in London and sales have dropped by, certain places like Mayfair have dropped by 70% in the last 2 or 3 months. People are genuinely just waiting it out. You know, it's affecting I think house prices in London have dropped by something like 3% in the last month, mainly because of this ripple effect from the higher properties, all because of somebody mentioning that there may be this. You know, this isn't actually come to fruition, but this is what happens when you start planting the seed and trying to, you know, this is typical of the governments, isn't it? They say, oh, we might do that, and they'll leak it into the market just to see whether or not it has the desired effect, or you know what I mean? It's a wrong way of doing it. There shouldn't be leaks.
No, but all there has been with this Labour government is a leak. I mean, Rachel Reeves basically gave a leak in her statement, didn't she? I mean, completely what she was planning to do. You know, I'm going to break my rules, basically, is what she said.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, she said she's not going to worry about making enemies and offending, you know, upsetting people. But let's move on to something a bit more, you know, light-hearted. So Formula One calendar, Kev. We've got the Brazilian Grand Prix this afternoon at 5 o'clock, Sao Paulo. And then on the 20th of November, we've got, obviously, move it into Las Vegas, which is an incredible circuit, you know, the street circuit there. And then the Qatar Grand Prix in Doha on the 28th. And then the final race of the calendar is the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, obviously remaining in the Middle East. We've got four races left. The current standings are Lando Norris leading ahead with 350, 1 point ahead of Oscar Piastri, his teammate at McLaren. And then we've got Verstappen at 321 points, so about 36 points behind. What do you make of it? Do you think Verstappen can still pull this one out of the bag? Would you rule him out?
No, he's definitely not ruled out. For sure, the two of them don't think he's ruled out either. So in a way, they're making it possible that he can catch them, because they're fighting with each other in terms of taking points off each other. So, yeah, no, he's got to go and win at least a couple of those races, I think, and hope that, you know, they have did not finish or whatever, but we will see. Anyway, we can talk about Liverpool now that they won last
week. Finally got a win in.
Against Aston Villa, and then they beat Real Madrid 1-0. Yeah. At Anfield.
You've got a big test this afternoon, mate. You've got City at City.
Yeah, big test at Manchester City, but with flying colours in the first two tests. I mean, we played brilliant against Real Madrid. They didn't have a sniff. And Courtois was the man of the match. So, I mean, let's see what happens. It's going to be a good game for Arsenal no matter what, because one team's going to take points off the other. And if Arsenal win, then they're going to go further ahead regardless of that result.
Absolutely. It was good to see us beat Spurs yesterday as well. So, you know, finally getting a good win in. We'll leave that in because obviously the game hasn't happened yet because we're recording on Friday. But I'd like to say the confidence we're going to beat Spurs.
Where are you playing Spurs at? White Hart Lane or not White Hart Lane?
It's at Spurs, yeah.
Yeah, I think we will see. We will see. I will say no comments. But, I mean, it's the European Champions League's hotting up. Obviously, we don't know what the final top eight's going to be until January, and then the 8 to 24 then play off with each other, don't they? And the bottom eight are booted out, basically. So, Liverpool are sitting eighth, I think. Arsenal are up there as well. Manchester City are up there. Tottenham are just behind. All very interesting stuff. How many teams have we got in the Champions League this year? Is it five?
Yeah, well, we've got obviously Chelsea, City.
It's five, yeah. Chelsea,
Newcastle.
Liverpool.
Now, the reason I said Chelsea and Chelsea-Barcelona is I've been invited to the game on the 25th of this month, Chelsea versus Barcelona, which should be amazing because I've not often been to Champions League games, and I think the atmosphere is generally, you know, pretty damn impressive, isn't it? You know, when you're with all the, you know, was it the champions and all, I don't know who sings it, Domingo or whatever.
That's because you're a United fan, you haven't
exactly,
been
we're never in it, exactly. It's been years since we've done it, but no, it should be exciting. I mean, Stamford Bridge is for me, is that I've never been there. I've always wanted to go. I've been to the Etihad and all the other clubs. I've been to Tottenham at White Hart Lane, the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, as it's now known. But yeah, first for me, looking forward to it. I think the stadium's only around 40,000 capacity, so very small in comparative terms to the likes of, you know, Anfield and City Ground and all that. But what do you, have you ever been, Kev? Any abiding memories of Chelsea?
Yeah, bad in memory. I think it was 1984. I went there. I think it was possibly an FA Cup, third, fourth round, something like that. Miserable, pouring down with rain. We were in the shed end, I think it was, and no cover at that time. So you just basically got rained on for 2 hours. And then they held us in for another 30 minutes, so you get super wet. And then we got let out, and we had to walk along to go to the tube. I mean, just my abiding memory was just getting lots of golf balls flying over the top of our heads. Basically, fortunately, none hit my head.
Good response to the Scousers then.
yeah, that was the good old days when you could safely go to a football match and have no consequences whatsoever. And then we got in the tube, scarves off, keep your mouth shut, and off we went. So yeah.
Okay, well, I think we've talked long enough there. If you like what you've heard, please do subscribe, hit the bell icon for future notifications of further episodes, and have a great weekend all. Thanks for listening. Yeah.
Thanks for listening, guys.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.